good afternoon and welcome to this panel discussion celebrating the Cambridge University Library's heroic acquisition of the Siegfried Sassoon Archive. My name, as you just heard, is John Swalworthy, and I must start by thanking the librarian for her ecumenical kindness and courtesy in offering an Oxford band the honour of opening these quintessentially Canterburgian proceedings. Think of this as a warm-up for the magnificent exhibition you're going to see when we have finished. An exhibition well entitled Dream Voices, Siegfried Sassoon, Memory and War. Acquisition and exhibition have been made possible by the generosity of many donors, individuals and institutions whose names are properly listed in the exhibition. We must all thank them all for a benefaction not only munificent but timely. Now, if you were to ask the men and women on the Clapham Omnibus for the name that comes first to mind when they hear the words First World War, I suspect it would be a clear win for Blackadder. The Sassoon may be a runner-up, or proxime accessit, as I understand they say in Cambridge. I'd bet a penny to a pound there'd be no field marshal, no prime minister, no historian on the Clapham shortlist. If I'm right, why should Sassoon outrank the great and good in the national memory? Because he was a great poet? No, I heretically can think of greater. Because he was a brave and bemedaled soldier who dared to protest against the war? No, not just that. Because he wrote best-selling trench memoirs? Not that alone, either, I think. But those three reasons have combined, surely, to earn him his unique niche in the national memory. Dulce et decorum est, as Horace said, it's sweet and fitting that academic institutions should honour their sons and daughters, even when, perhaps especially when, they did not go the academic distance. In Oxford, we rejoice in the fact that University College, which cast poet Shelley into outer darkness for presuming to write and publish a pamphlet called The Necessity of Atheism, subsequently reinstated him, naked and in bronze, in a pietà pose that lacked only his mother, dare I say, his alma mater. Perhaps encouraged by Shelley's example, on the 14th of July 1916, a fortnight after the terrible opening of the Battle of the Somme, which he witnessed, Sassoon sent his friend Edward Dent a sketch of the equestrian statue he wanted erected on Market Hill, Cambridge, after his demise. He must have suspected a very imminent demise. Now, if he remembered his Horace, as I'm sure all Cambridge men of his generation, maybe not all generations, remember their Horace, he would have remembered another line from the Roman poet's odes, Exequi monumentum aeri perennius. My work is done, the memorial more lasting than bronze. I'm sure Sassoon would have preferred us to be celebrating the acquisition of his manuscripts by the Cambridge University Library than the unveiling of his statue, either clothed or naked, on Market Hill. Let me now introduce, at slightly more length, the first of our distinguished speakers. On my immediate right, Lord Egremont, Max Egremont, and you'll know him for many things. His magisterial biography, Siegfried Sassoon, a biography, which when next reprinted, I think should be retitled, Siegfried Sassoon, the biography. This followed his earlier biographies of Wilfrid Scawen Blunt and George Wyndham, a book called The Cousins, Arthur Balfour and Major General Sir Edward Spears. He has, there are two writerly egremonts. This first one, I think, has a new book appearing next spring, Forgotten Land, A Journey Among the Ghosts of East Prussia. The other writerly Max is Max the Novelist, author of The Ladies' Man, Dear Shadows, Painted Lives, and Second Spring. You'll also know Max the encourager, the mover and shaker of many British cultural institutions. Chairman of the Friends of the National Libraries, a trustee of the Wallace Collection, the British Museum, the National Manuscripts Conservation Trust, and in that connection, one of those most deserving of our and the nation's gratitude for helping to secure and build up the Sassoon Archive. I could go on, but I won't. Simply asking Max to tell us about a life of contradictions.
Thank you, John. Well, I must say I find it very difficult to recognise myself from that introduction. Perhaps I should say that I also come from the other university, from Oxford, and it's very nice to be here, and how absolutely splendid it is that the papers are at Cambridge. I couldn't be happier about that. Now, it seems appropriate for a poet of war that there were contradictions and tensions from the very start of Siegfried Sassoon's life. This half-Jewish Englishman was born in 1886 as the son of Alfred Sassoon and Teresa Thornycroft. There was conflict even before Siegfried was born, because the Sassoons didn't at all approve of Alfred getting married to a Gentile. In fact, old Mrs. Sassoon, Alfred's mother, cut him completely out of her life. And it was strangely symbolic, well not strangely, it was extremely symbolic, I think, this, because Sassoon, for most of his life, didn't exactly forget about his Jewish heritage, but he liked to put it to one side. In fact, strangely, he said only towards the end of his life, after he became a Catholic convert in 1957, did he become interested in it, and did he see how important a part it had played in the sort of person he was. But who were the Sassoons? They were Sephardic Jews. They came originally from Iraq, from Basra. They went to Bombay and to Hong Kong and to London, and they made huge amounts of money from trading. And in London they became a very important part of the Jewish circle who surrounded King Edward VII. So one might say that they joined the establishment in this country. They were enormously rich, and Sassoon, although not hugely rich, he inherited a certain amount of this great fortune, and this meant he never had to earn his living for the whole of his life. When he inherited a really very considerable sum of money from an aunt in 1928, he was even able to buy a large country house in the English countryside. The Thornycrofts, the family of Siegfried's mother, Teresa, were different. They were very English, and they prided themselves on being very English. They came from farming stock in Cheshire. It's very significant, I think, this. For all his life, Siegfried Sassoon cherished the English countryside, the English country life. He regarded life in the country as being the true virtuous life, far more than life in the city. He regarded cities, I think, essentially as dark places, and I think you can see this in his work. But by 1886, by the time that Siegfried was born, the Thornycrofts had transformed themselves into artists. Siegfried's mother was a considerable artist of a pre-Raphaelite type. Siegfried's uncle, Hamo, was a very considerable sculptor, and so was his grandfather, Thomas, and so was his grandmother, Mary. they discovered, the Thornycrofts, Thomas and Hamo, discovered a very nice line in statues of great Victorians or historical figures. Indeed, in certain parts of London, it's very difficult to escape a statue by either Thomas or Hamo Thornycroft. You go to Westminster Bridge, you see this massive, hideous, bombastic thing of Boadicea. You walk along a little bit, you see another statue of Oliver Cromwell by Hamo. You go along up to the Strand, you see a statue of Gladstone, also by Hamo. You go down to Winchester, you see King Alfred by Hamo. You go to India, you can't even get away from them in India. George V, Curzon, Queen Victoria, Edward VII, the assassinated Viceroy Lord Mayo, all by the Thornycroft. And then there was Mary Thornycroft. She worked on a much smaller scale. She worked a great deal for the royal family. She was commissioned by Queen Victoria to do works of her children, Queen Victoria's children. They're very curious works, these. If you go to Osborne, you'll see Princess Louise's arm, Princess Beatrice's leg, Prince Leopold's hand. Something sort of sinister about this. And of course, it was at the time, it was not in the least bit meant to be sinister. In addition to this, the Thornycrofts were very considerable engineers. John Thornycroft had a very successful engineering business near Southampton. There was something a little prim about the Thornycrofts, a little puritanical. Theresa was the most tremendous Tory. And when Siegfried was introduced to Rupert Brooke just before the First War, he found himself thinking, now, would my father really approve of a man who didn't comb his hair properly and wore sandals with bare feet? He thought about this, and then he decided that she would not. I think this influenced his view of Brooke. Theresa, who didn't die until 1948, played a tremendously important part in Siegfried's life. She was very different to Alfred Sassoon, whom she married, who was essentially a pleasure-loving dilettante, and they moved to Kent, they set up house down there, and perhaps almost inevitably the marriage very quickly began to fail. And Alfred left, he went off with another woman when Siegfried was only 4 years old, a great shame for Theresa in those days to be an abandoned woman, an abandoned wife in late Victorian England. It was a shameful position to be in, so it was a shock to her, and she never completely got over this. And partly in revenge, she brought her three sons up in an almost aggressively English way. She pushed their Jewish heritage completely to one side. But there was the odd interlude breaking through this English life. When Alfred died, Alfred left when Siegfried soon was four. He died of tuberculosis when Siegfried was only 9 years old. The interlude was the two boys, Siegfried didn't go because he was thought by Theresa to be too delicate, the two boys going off to Alfred's funeral in the Jewish cemetery in the Mile End Road. So it was a confused background. So much was hidden. The boys were sent to private schools, to public schools, to Marlborough. Siegfried was a frail child, often ill. But here again, I think one sees a contradiction. He was a very brave horseman. So you've got the frailty on the one side and the courage on the other. He was, I think, the mother's favourite. Theresa adored him. And this always gave him a sense, I believe, that he was one of the elect, something slightly special, something different. He was unsuccessful at school, he wasn't good at work, he wasn't good at games. But he quite quickly, at a very early age, discovered that he could write poetry. And this became a refuge for him. It was one field in which he could excel. As he grew older, there was another aspect of his life that set him apart. He was a homosexual. He discovered this quite early on in his teens. He had a sense always, I think, of being a slightly Byronic figure, of being set apart from others, of being different. He slightly gloried in this solitude. Yet, and here again is a paradox, for the whole of his life he admired the English public school ideal. He admired, obviously, decent people. He disliked people who were too flamboyant, too showy. He liked modesty. He liked good sense. He distrusted fluency. He distrusted articulacy. At home, the house in Kent, there was an artistic atmosphere because Theresa, in the tradition of her family, painted and she sculpted. She painted these huge Pre-Raphaelite pictures, one called The Hours, an extraordinary picture of these series of women apparently walking very slowly across the canvas from one side to the other. What one might describe as a poem painted on canvas, but mixed in with all this, partly through his mother and his uncle Hamo's friendship with Edmund Gosse, who was a great literary figure at the time, there was a link to the Yellow Book, to the whole Founder-Sieck world, the slightly decadent world of the 1890s. I think one can see this, one can see this reflected, the Founder-Sieck world, the world of the Yellow Book, in those whom he loved. Gabriel Atkin, his first great love at the end of the First War, was a decadent alcoholic, very much perhaps in the style of Lionel Johnson. Stephen Tennant, much more Aubrey Beardsley. Hester Gatty, whom he eventually got married to in 1933, was always described as a beauty of the Pre-Raphaelite type. In his pre-war poetry, he went back to the great Victorians, obviously to Tennyson, Browning, to Swinburne, but he also went back to the 1890s as well. Trouble with the pre-war stuff, and he became very, very exercised by this, is that there was a huge gap between his great ambition and the reality of the work itself. It was all privately printed in very delicate little volumes. Edmund Gosse was unimpressed to begin with. There was a brief flare-up when he did a parody of a Masefield poem. The parody was called The Daffodil Murderer, in the Georgian style, which was much more down-to-earth language, much more realistic. This was a success, but he wasn't able to build on this. So before the war, there was a sense of drifting, augmented by the private income. There was nothing to tie him down to the earth, so to speak. But then in 1914, it's extraordinary to think about this now, with the tragedy of the First World War. The war solved everything for him. It gave him something to write about. It set up this great tension that was to be the inspiration of his greatest work. The beginning of the tension, I think, was the rubbing together of the boyhood ideals of patriotism, chivalry, the sort of thing that he would have been imbued with in his public school education, against the reality of the hideous war of the trenches and the deaths of those whom he loved. This set up in him a very real anger, which I don't think he ever felt again. And the great satirical poems that he produced during the First War are, I think, unique in his work. The satires that he wrote after 1918 don't come up to their standard, because I think he wasn't really angry after 1918. We all know the story of his war, how Siegfried's War is largely the way that we see the First War today. The terrible conditions in the trenches, the blundering generals, the attacks across the lunar landscape, the horror of it all, the sense of innocence betrayed. Out of this, again, I think one sees a contradiction. He was a very brave officer. He won the Military Cross, and yet he protested against the war in 1917. Here again, there's a tension, and this was a tension that lasted for the whole of the rest of his life. He thought endlessly about this protest. He used to ponder it and over it in his mind, and one sees this in the journals. Again and again, he asks himself about it in the 20s, the 30s, particularly in the 40s and 50s, towards the end of his life. He asked himself, had it been a form of cowardice? Had his time out of the line? Sassoon wasn't in the trenches for very long, quite long enough. Had all his time out of the line precluded him from talking about the war with any great degree of authority? And above all, he asked himself, could he have stood any more time in the trenches? He always had this slight sense of precarious manhood, which I think goes back to his very early youth asked himself these questions again and again and again. It's a part of the contradictions in his life. The war ended in 1918. Much, much was expected of him. He was already a celebrated figure. But somehow he withdrew. He began to withdraw a little bit. And he went back, partly to the old Founders' world. He became friends with essentially figures of the 1890s, like the Sitwells, Lord Berners, Beerbohm, Stephen Tennant, or older writers like Hardy. The 1920s was an unsatisfactory time for him. And then at the end of the 1920s, he had his great success with his prose book, The Memoirs of a Fox Hunting Man. Here again, this set up, and one sees this in the journals and he sees in the exhibition, a tension. He felt the book was too cramped, too tidy. He felt he ought to have told the truth. He ought to have written a rambling homosexual novel, perhaps in the style of André Gide. There was a very strong Puritan streak in him, I feel, which comes from his mother. Of course, part of the reason he didn't write this book was because he didn't want to embarrass his mother. Somebody apparently said to Ian Forster that he, André Gide, is honest about his homosexuality, he writes all these books, he tells the truth, why don't you? Ian Forster's harm, but Gide hasn't got a mother. It was a huge success, The Memoirs of a Fox Hunting Man, as so often with writers. He felt that the success was built on weak foundations. It doesn't bother me. He felt this. He wasn't satisfied with it. He felt also he was honest about himself. One sees this in the journals again and again. He felt that his post-1918 work was a beautiful, glowing memory rather than a bright fire. He felt this especially true, I think, of the what one might describe as the genuine autobiographies, the old century, The Wheel of Youth, Siegfried Journey, which are very beautiful books, but they're a bit like a 17th century Dutch landscape. You look at them and you think, what a beautiful, wonderful, slightly static scene. He felt he hadn't told the truth about it. It was a very strong aspect of his life, I think, which is often overlooked. He felt that he created these utopian worlds, The Fox Hunting Man, The Wheel of Youth, these beautiful, beautiful books, but they weren't the truth. It tormented him. And he became further tormented when the whole literary fashion seemed to move away from him. T.S. Eliot, Ezra Pound, the new poetry, what one might describe as the modernist revolution. This was something he had no sympathy with. He wanted structure, he wanted beauty. He didn't want fragmentation. He wanted things to come together. He wanted to be able to look at life and think that is how it should be. There's a beautiful, beautiful view, something that I've created myself. And then he got married in 1933. Inevitably, the marriage started quite soon to fail. There was a flare-up of real delight when George, his son, was born in 1936. But even this died eventually as George grew up. He began to leave home. There were the terrible tensions of the marriage. But then, in 1957, everything seemed to be answered, perhaps for the first time in his life, when he converted to Roman Catholicism. I think here one sees the ultimate paradox. The rebel of 1917 submitted to the greatest authority of all, perhaps, the Roman Catholic Church. There was no more questioning. The great thing about Sassoon's war poetry is it's about questioning. It's about challenging. There was no more questioning. There was no more challenging. He was happy to repose in the bosom of the Church. He said when he was undergoing instruction at Downside, he said, don't let's bother with all this. You know, I accept everything. You can say what you like. I just want to convert as quickly as possible. And the very nice monk whom I went to see who was converting said, but secret, we must go through it, you know, a little bit. You know. No, nothing. Take me to the Pope. But it's an extraordinary paradox, perhaps the last great paradox, because how do we remember him today? As John said so absolutely right. We remember him as a subversive figure. We remember him as the man who created the way that we see the First World War today. This was not probably how he would want to be remembered. I asked myself when coming up here, how would he feel about today? How would he feel about the fact we were all gathered here to remember? He'd be very happy about that. He had a slightly vain man, why not? A slightly vain man. He would be very pleased that the manuscripts have been saved, but he would not want to be remembered as a poet of the First World War. What I think he would want to be remembered as would be as the poet of the religious poems that he wrote towards the end of his life. He thought that these were very great. Well, unfortunately, very few people share that opinion. That was how he wanted to be remembered. And this, I think, is one of the things that made him such a fascinating writer, is that throughout his life, one sees these tensions resolving themselves, other ones appear. A series of clashes, really, almost a series of Hegelian clashes. They don't really resolve themselves until the conversion in 1957. But posterity has, I think, been able to resolve them for him. And we now see him as an extraordinary product of the 20th century, a great poet, I think, within certain limitations, a great poet, and again, I think within certain limitations, a great prose writer. But we go back always, 1914 to 1918, that was the time that he was in his prime.
Savanu Das, I'm a senior English teacher, lecturer in English at Queen Mary University of London, having held fellowships at St John's College here in Cambridge and at the British Academy. He's the author of Touch and Intimacy in the First World War Literature and the editor of Race, Empire and the First World War, a book forthcoming from the Cambridge Press. He's now at work on India and the First World War writing and is to give the British Academy chapter and lecture later this year on the poetry of D.H. Lawrence. Let me ask him now to tell us about Love in the Time of War.
Thank you, Felix. I have circulated a handout, I hope, you know, most of you have got it. In the beginning was a face, and the face belonged to a young Sandhurst subaltern. The diarist and the poet's pen, as much as the lover's eye, dwells lovingly, longingly. On the fair hair, I quote, the kind, sleepy gaze. This was none other than David Cuthbert Thomas, the Dick Tiltwood of Memoirs of a Fox-Hunting Man, 10 years younger than Sassoon, and perhaps the first in the long list of young, beautiful men in Sassoon's life. For Sassoon, from the first tedious days of infantry training at Litterland in 1915 to the moonlit trenches of the Western Front, Tommy, as he called him, became nothing short of the perfect gentle knight. And the young writings bask in the physical presence of David Cuthbert Thomas. But by March 1916, Thomas was dead, hit by a stray bullet on the throat. The death of Thomas becomes almost a still point in the turning universe of Sassoon's early emotional, poetic, and military life. And I'd like to focus on this event in order to explore the various selves of this famously self-divided man, as Max Egremont had been speaking so eloquently. What is the relationship between the shy romantic poet and lover, the fox-hunting half-Jewish Englishman, and the gallant officer Mad Jack Sassoon of First World War historiography? Or, to put the question differently, do the death of Tommy and its various representations and repercussions provide an insight into an intimate history of emotions as well as the politics of literary form. After all, Sassoon revisits this moment in different genres, in his diary, in his poetry, in his memoir. What do these different kinds of writing tell us about the moment as well about the writer? In Memoirs of the Fox Hunting Man, 1928, Sassoon writes, and I quote, this is the first item in the handout, "A sack was lowered into a hole in the ground. The sack was Dick. I knew death then." The stylized monosyllabic flatness of tone of this retrospective account, intended for a wider readership, is very different from the tumultuous emotions of the diary entry for 19th March 1918, the day after Tommy was killed. And I thought this is the second item on the handout, and I'll just kind of read only a kind of few bits from it. "Now he comes back to me in memories like an angel, with the light in his yellow hair, and I think of him in Cambridge last August, where the previous occupant's name, Paradise, was written above the door. Grief can be beautiful when we find something worthy to be mourned. Today I knew what it means to find the soul washed pure with tears, and the load of death was lifted from my heart. So I wrote his name in chalk on the beech tree stem, and left a rough garland of ivy there, and a yellow primrose for his yellow hair, and kind grey eyes, my dear, my dear." What is astonishing here is not just the aestheticization of grief, but the literalization of the genre of pastoral elegy. The tropes of a classical genre are turned into physical tokens of mourning, showing its deep hold upon Edwardian men of a particular class, education, and sensibility. Keatsian sensuousness is evolved into a language of longing and loss. But like the red wet of Ivor Gurney's To His Love, blood seeps through and stains Sassoon's pastoral carapace. For just 2 weeks after Tommy's death, in an unpublished poem, Memory, Sassoon writes how he's haunted, I quote, by his blood, that is Tommy's blood. "I thought of rivers flowing red and crimson hands that led him in his bed." What is the relationship between love and death? And the third missing term, that is violence, in this year, along these few months. In the context of another war, Keats Douglas famously wrote of the lover and the killer mingled, who had one body and one heart. The phrase applies to Sassoon of April and May 1916 with eerie precision. For if the war had caused the lover mortal hurt, it had also inflamed the killer. This is the diary entry of April 1st, 1916, and this is the item number 3 in the handout. "I used to say I couldn't kill anyone in this war, but since they shot Tommy, I'd gladly stick a bayonet into a German by daylight. Someone had told me a year ago that love, sorrow, and hate were things I'd never known. Now I've known love for Bobby and Tommy, and grief for Hamu and Tommy, and hate has come also, and the lust to kill." In the poem Peace, composed the next day perhaps, he writes of, I quote, "Annoying hunger drives me wild to be assuaged, and bitter lust chuckles within me unashamed." And indeed, this was followed by a rare spate of violence on his part as he famously raided the German trenches with revolver, Nokkerian hand grenades, enacting out a bizarre revenge plot, though he also writes about the futility of such an act. Love, lust, anger, violence, and a death wish are fused and confused. Does homoerotic desire, being repressed, frustrated, and thwarted, get translated into acts of violence at this particular moment in history? On March 31st, Sassoon had written, I quote, "Tonight I'm going to try and spot one of their working parties and chuck some bombs at them. I find it most exhilarating, just like starting for a race." The interesting word is exhilarating, and is quite close to the extraordinary exaltation that Wilfred Owen speaks about while describing the act of going over the top. And I think I've given you that quote also, yes, on the handout. There was an extraordinary exaltation in the act of slowly walking forward, slowly showing ourselves openly. And these sentiments are often expunged from the sanitized pacifist narratives that have been built around these two anti-war poets. But both Sassoon and Owen, perhaps, are also bearing powerful, if disturbing, testimony to the truth of the body, along with their very strong pacifist politics. Something that, interestingly, Sigmund Freud placed at the very heart of his Civilization and Its Discontents, written in 1923, very much in the shadow of the First World War. And Freud writes, "In the blindest fury of destructiveness, we cannot fail to recognize that the satisfaction of the instinct is accompanied by an extraordinary high degree of narcissistic enjoyment." And then after 2 months, again, we are back to the pastoral plot. At Flixcourt in May 1916, Sassoon writes A Last Meeting, his longest war poem. The poem takes the form of a quest for David through a darkening city and an empty house till he finds him amidst the wood where David now speaks. "I triumph in the choruses of birds, bursting like April buds in jars of song. I've been tired and watchful, craving rest, till the slow-footed hours have touched my brows and laid me on the breast of sundering sleep." The vocabulary is reminiscent of Shelley's Adonais. If there, the leprous corpse exhales itself in flowers of gentle breath. Thomas's due to solid flesh, now once with the freezing sludge, must similarly be redeemed and woven into a fantasy of purity and disembodiedness and mystical union with nature. Yet the idea of the dead David speaking goes beyond the limits of the pastoral elegy and is deeply poignant in a culture when thousands of people, including Sassoon's mother, were desperately trying to get in touch with the dead. Behind the body of Thomas that is being resurrected in this poem also lies that of Hammo, Sassoon's brother killed in Gallipoli, and Bobby Hanmer away in Salonika. On 6th April, Sassoon writes, "I can't keep them clear in memory. They fade with their bright hair and happy eyes." And behind them lie his own tired body, craving rest, as the body of the mourner and the mourned meet in the phantasmatic embrace of sundering sleep. It is also a vision of Englishness, though Rosenberg perhaps would have been quick to point out that it's a very class-specific vision of Englishness. But Wilfred Owen perhaps would have been more alert to the poignant sexual politics underlying this genre. If we look at the manuscript version of this poem housed in Cambridge University Library, we realize that it is happy with acutely personal details. And the last line in this manuscript version reads, I quote, "and lips that touched me once in paradise," referring back to the room at Pembroke College, Cambridge. If the church, the state and society had reduced his homosexuality to a crime, a sin, an aberration, Sassoon would fall back on a genre which not only had the weight of classical antiquity, but is incorporated in the main tradition of Englishness, from Milton to Shelley to Arnold, and thus place his love in a continuum of male intimacy and loss. And it also kind of fits in with this idea of what Max said as him kind of this fondness for decency, for a kind of decent tradition. And yet, in the 1919 collection of war poems and all subsequent editions, this paradisal kiss is changed into a dying one. "And youth, the dying, touched my lips to song." But the kiss is never a simple trope in Sassoon's poetry, and Professor Kendall is going to talk more about the kiss now.
Wait a little for the kiss. Let me explain that Tim Kendall is head of English at the University of Exeter. He's both a poet and a distinguished critic of poetry, has written wonderful studies of Paul Muldoon and Sylvia Plath. And what particularly will be of interest to you will be his study of modern English war poetry. He's working now on a 3-volume, very honorable edition of the poems of Ivor Gurney. Tim's also a widely consulted blogographer, who this afternoon is going to, now I can say, tell us about kissing and killing.
Well, thank you, everyone. It's a great pleasure to be here. I'd like to thank John for the kind introduction. I'd like to thank Max and John and Anne, who I think were the people responsible for inviting me to come along. And I'd just like to add my voice to the many voices of congratulations for the university having kept Sassoon's papers. We'll see in a moment at the exhibition that they're already, that, you know, they're in the right place, these papers. They're not going to be boxed up and put in the bowels of the library. They're going to be used, they're going to be enjoyed. And I think there are two reasons why that's important and why this, it's important that the nation should have saved the papers. The first is that, as my predecessors here today have already said, Sassoon is an iconic figure. He's more than a poet, dare I say, more than a poet. He is very closely associated with our understanding of the First World War. But the second reason, which I think is paradoxical in the light of the first, is that Sassoon can seem rather like, from a distance, can seem rather like a small poet. He is a poet. He's kind of, you know, the one who's not quite as good as Wilfred Owen. It's always the same half a dozen poems of his that are in the First World War anthologies. And one thing that I think is very clear from the exhibition is, and not least from Max's talk as well, is that he is a poet of contradictions. He is far more complex than those simple anthology pieces would give us reason to believe. So what I hope is that the availability of these papers, you know, adding to what Cambridge University already had, will create a new wave of interest and a new, more sophisticated approach to Sassoon in literary criticism. He's been the subject of, again, I won't spare Max's blushes, a wonderful life. But in literary critical terms, I think he has been actually not very well dealt with to date. And it's a wonderful thing that the exhibition's here. I suppose that the story of Sassoon, again, from a distance that people might have, the narrative of Sassoon, when I say he's a small poet, or is considered as such, is that here is a poet who writes terrifically well one kind of poem, a small lyric, typically, a lyric that has within it what Paul Fussell terms the versus habit, that's V-E-R-S-U-S, the versus habit, a kind of us and them irony, which Fussell links particularly with the First World War, or believes is, if you like, born out of the First World War, and that the us and them, the them of the us and them, isn't so much or isn't so often Fritz, you know, the mirror image across no man's land, the secret sharer, the fellow sufferer, who's also a kind of Isaac to the Abrahams who are sacrificing him. It isn't so much Fritz. It's the enemy behind the lines. It's the Scarlet Majors. It's the Bishop of London. It's the glory of women, that devastating phrase, that devastating ambiguity of Sassoon's, you make us shells. The way that there's a kind of misogynistic streak in Sassoon. And then there's the politicians and newspaper barons that he has in his sights in the famous Declaration. There's a draft that you'll see in the exhibition where Sassoon in 1917 comes to believe, the fact that he comes to believe it continues to drive military historians completely round the bend, but he comes to believe in 1917 that there is a peace available and that the war is being prolonged beyond its necessary duration by politicians who have turned it from a war of liberation into a war of conquest. So that's the Sassoon of us and them, the bitter irony, which, of course, also exposes the language of these power brokers, the way that they talk about war, the way that they have glorified war, the chivalry, the nobility of war. So irony is a way of exposing the rhetoric, the politician's rhetoric of war. And then I suppose the story carries on, and Max has talked very well about this, of Sassoon feeling in a sense like he has survived his reputation, that, you know, after the war, the writings after the war are neglected, they go down a kind of cul-de-sac, ignored by readers. Well, actually, they sell quite well, but they're ignored by the scholars. And Sassoon comes to regret Owen's death, not only for its own sake and the loss of a friend, but also because he believes that had Owen survived, he and Owen together might have done what Sassoon couldn't do on his own, which was to change the course of English poetry, to rescue it from the modernists. And in that ambition, of course, Sassoon is also lamenting the lost friendship with Robert Graves. What's the last line of the Robert Graves poem? Oh God, what poetry will write, you know, after the war is finished. And of course that friendship becomes fractured and finally falls into, I think, animosity, it's fair to say. They're frenemies, to use a modern word. So so Sassoon feels like a coelacanth. You know, he's kind of outside his natural time. Now, all of that is true. I mean, like any caricature, it's effective as a narrative that we have of Sassoon because there is a great deal of truth in it. But it's not the whole truth. And I think this is why the papers are so important, that they show us the other things which Sassoon did and the things which complicate that record. And I wanted really just to pick up on what Santanu said, to curse him for stealing one or two of the quotations that I was going to use. That's all right, now I'll get you later. And just to say, you know, one thing that has always interested me about Sassoon and about the First World War more generally, when we think of the First World War poet, when Blackadder thinks of the First World War poet, what they think of is, to use that Yeats's phrase, which he borrows off Matthew Arnold, passive suffering. And Yeats excludes First World War poets from the canon because he doesn't think passive suffering is a theme for poetry. What First World War poets do is they die. They suffer and they die. And as Santanu has already suggested, in Sassoon's case, one of the things which has been omitted from the record is the fact that Sassoon is also, you know, we might feel a bit squeamish about this, but he's also a very good killer. And what I've put on your handouts is a poem which actually is quite often anthologised by Sassoon, called The Kiss, which strikes me as one of the great poems, and actually one of the few poems from the First World War about the soldier's job of killing the enemy. So I'll just read it out to you. I know you'd be familiar with it already, but I'll read it out again, The Kiss. To these I turn, in these I trust, brother lead and sister steel. To his blind power I make appeal, I guard her beauty clean from rust. He spins and burns and loves the air, and splits a skull to win my praise. But up the nobly marching days, she glitters naked, cold, and fair. Sweet sister, grant your soldier this, that in good fury he may feel the body where he sets his heel quail from your downward darting kiss. Now, in the exhibition, I hadn't known this, I've only just discovered it this afternoon, but in the exhibition, as luck would have it, there is Sassoon's draft, or Sassoon's notes, of a lecture which he attended, which formed the basis or the inspiration for this poem, The Kiss. He attended a lecture on how to use the bayonet, and it's full of gruesome details. Where do you stick the bayonet? John has already said to me, you know, it's as if we'd have time when, you know, the Hun is hurtling towards you, know, where do you stick him? Kidneys are apparently a really good spot if ever you're in that situation. But so he talks about what do you do, how deep do you stick the bayonet? If you go right through the body, it's wasted fury, all this kind of thing. And Sassoon feels exhilarated and appalled having heard this lecture. And he writes this poem, which, as he says, doesn't show any sign of satire. This strikes me as a kind of failed Sassoon poem. It looks all for all the world like it's going to be one of Sassoon's poems of bitter irony, and which in fact turns out to be a disturbing kind of celebration of the power of the weaponry of war. It has, I think, that added disturbance that the sexual imagery just seems all wrong. First of all, that it's a kiss that's being described for something that's far more penetrative. Without going into too many details, it's obvious what it might have been. But also the kind of... No, it's not even a kind of... The pimping of the sister into the body of the German soldier. So there's a kind of sexual imagery in there that doesn't quite work. And because it doesn't quite work, it's all the more gruesome and all the more effective. Now, I just wanted to highlight this issue of the bayonet, because Sassoon had said himself that he didn't believe he could ever stick a bayonet in anyone. That said, as Santanu stole, you know, after Tommy is killed, Sassoon says, you know, his idea of revenge is to stick a bayonet in a German by daylight. I love that great addition, but he wants to see this. You know, at night time, he wouldn't get a proper view of it. He wants to do it by daylight. That's the visceral nature of the revenge fantasy that Sassoon has there. And underneath, I've printed what is actually an unpublished poem currently by Ivor Gurney, also about bayonets, which uses the same word, fair, to describe the bayonet. Gurney had a similar anxiety. He was very pleased when he got sent to man a machine gun post, even though it's a dangerous place to be in, because, of course, it's where the enemy is targeting. Gurney had no compunction about shooting Germans. He thought this was fine, you know, that's just what you did. But he didn't like the idea of, as he put it, sticking Germans. So you can see there's an intimacy. You know, technology hasn't yet rendered the bayonet entirely obsolete in the First World War. And there's an intimacy about stabbing, which, of course, encourages these sexual metaphors in particular. So I think, really, that's what I wanted to say today. That there are aspects... You know, Sassoon, yes, he's a radical. Yes, he's, in some ways, a disruptive presence. But the way that he's taught at schools... and at undergraduate level, the way that we know all these anthology pieces, there's actually something quite comfortable, I think, about Sassoon's reputation. And I think it's time that, you know, using the papers, using the archives and so on, we can see these things that still should upset us, that still should disrupt our notion of who Sassoon was and what the First World War was like. Thank you very much.